You're listening to the annual Homelessness Marathon on your local community radio station. I'm Elissa Matthews, the program director for CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. CJRU broadcasts from the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and, most recently, the territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation. Our program today includes reporting and interviews from a number of our spoken word programs at CJRU that have covered Toronto's homelessness crisis. Anti-poverty activists have long been calling for the city to take action to bolster Toronto's overcrowded shelter system and fund more affordable housing. As extreme cold weather this winter puts massive strain on the shelter system, City Hall faces added public pressure to take action. From a January 15th episode of The Scope News, CJRU reporter Mick Sweetman brings us more on the status of Toronto's homelessness crisis. We'll update his report after. Here's Mick Sweetman.
Kathy Kerr is a street nurse and a longtime advocate around homelessness in Toronto. We spoke with her last month after City Council voted against the motion to ask the federal government to use the armories as emergency shelters. Since then, there have been 21 days designated as extreme cold weather alerts when the temperature is negative 15 degrees or colder, or minus 20 with wind chill. Over the holidays, friendly workers reported not being able to find space for people in the shelter system or the six winter respite sites set up by the city. On January 4th, the city reversed its position and asked the federal government for the use of the armory. 2 days later, it was open and is now operating at capacity. The city also opened two warming centers at the Regent Park Community Center and Metro Hall. On January 14th, the permanent emergency shelter system was operating at a 95% capacity with 5,677 people and another 716 people at temporary shelters, drop-ins, and warming centers. We were able to reach Kathy Crow on the phone to talk about what's happened so far this winter with Toronto's homeless.
When we talked last in December, where you were calling for the armories to be opened, now they have been, and the city's actually saying that they're at capacity. Can you kind of maybe give our listeners a quick rundown on kind of what's happened over the last few weeks?
Sure. The mayor and the city did ask the federal government finally for use of the armory, and they predicted a Monday opening. This was right around New Year's weekend, and it opened 48 hours quicker. Shows you how, you know, what we always said, that it can be done very fast. The first few nights, the armory, I don't know, had a range of between 20 to 40 people, but within a matter of days, it's now full. I've been to the location a few times. It's exactly how I remember it always operating in the past. You know, it's a very large space with cots. It's clean. There are showers and washrooms, and it's being supported by city staff and Salvation Army are bringing in meals, and there's a clothing room. And by all accounts, people are appreciating what's offered there, and it's full. So there you go. The armory as an emergency shelter site really works.
So now that the armory is open, you know, and it's being fully utilized, what's next in terms of what's needed for housing in Toronto?
Well, the armory's, they only gave the armory for a couple of weeks, and an extension had to be negotiated until January 29. The province has come up with a building on George Street that they're offering for a replacement for when the armory closes, and that's a former youth detention site. In the meantime, everything is still very chaotic. We have fairly full emergency 24-hour respite centers that are open. They're pretty full. So the conditions in some of them are extremely intolerable. And then in addition, the city has added on another layer called warming centers that kind of open and close. Them being a Metro Hall, which is a civic building, and the Regent Park Community Center. So it's kind of a chaotic day-by-day experience trying to find out what's open, what's got space, what's happening next. And what we're doing now is we're lobbying to try to keep the Fort York Armory open beyond January 29 because it's such a good facility. And we're trying to get the city budget to budget for 1,000 real shelter beds.
Yeah, you mean the Moss Park Armory, correct?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I mean Moss Park.
Why do you think that it's more permanent shelter beds that are needed and not different forms of housing?
Well, it's not that we don't need different forms of housing. It's just that there's no housing program money that's flowing right now. So even if that money was flowing, it would probably be a year, year and a half, 2 years before there were construction sites and holes in the ground. So it means that we have to deal with emergency shelter in the meantime. And in April, on April 15th, there are going to be 650 people that are currently in winter respite or overnight emergency programs for this winter that are suddenly going to be welcome, you know, invited to go out the door, and there will be no place for them to go. So that seems unjust. It seems like we have the proof now to show that we need 1,000 more shelter beds to bring shelter capacity down to 90% and for these people to come into a real shelter. And the proof's been there for a long time, but it's really clear right now we have to have more shelters.
So it's a case of getting these permanent shelter beds with the standards that meet the shelters in the City of Toronto as your immediate thing. But in terms of getting people out of the shelter and into housing, what do you think is needed from the different levels of government?
We need the National Housing Strategy money to start flowing, and that means the provinces are going to have to match some of the money, and the Canada Housing Allowance that is scheduled to start in 2020, that would be like money that, you know, would be considered like a rent supplement. I think we have to see it happen sooner. And the province has apparently got a lot of empty properties available. It took them a long time to offer this one on George Street for emergency shelter. And we need to see them starting to offer some of these properties to the city for development into housing. So there has to be pressure on the senior levels of government for sure.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say that you think is important for people to know in terms of the shelter and the housing crisis here in Toronto?
Just for people to really know who their elected representatives are, to be passing on their feelings to them on this matter. And it's budget time at the City of Toronto, and big decisions are going to be made. So I urge people to write their city councillor and the mayor to let their views be known about how city spending and taxation should take place.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kathy. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, Nick.
That was Kathy Crowe. She's a longtime street nurse here in the City of Toronto and an anti-homelessness activist. She's also a distinguished visiting practitioner at Ryerson University.
Mick Sweetman, The Scope News.
Since this report aired, the emergency shelter space at the Moss Park Armory has closed, as has the Metro Hall Warming Center. The George Street Winter Respite site has opened. Last week, George Street was at capacity at least one night, and Toronto surpassed 800 people staying in the 24-hour respite warming centers. On February 12th, Toronto City Council carried a motion that would expedite the expansion of permanent shelter beds by 1,000 in 2018. In response to the motion carrying, Kathy Crowe tweeted, quote, "I'm speechless thanks to all the advocates for the right to shelter and Kristen Wong Tam and the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty Toronto. Wish we could name the motion after Pierre, who died last year on the night of the 2017 budget vote. This is an important step to heal and save lives," unquote.
This is Emily Joveski for CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. Women in positions of precarious housing face added challenges and fewer options for shelter, especially if they experience drug addiction or complex mental health problems. Sistering is a low-barrier agency that serves women who can't go anywhere else, and they are severely lacking in funding and resources. Sistering is petitioning the city to dedicate a new shelter facility to the women's agency. I spoke with Sistering Executive Director Patricia O'Connell to find out more about the conditions vulnerable women are facing in Toronto and how Sistering is making a difference. Hello, Patricia, and thanks for speaking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm always very happy to talk about Sistering.
Tell me about the kinds of services that Sistering provides to homeless and precariously housed women.
We operate a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week drop-in center for these women. We provide the basic necessities of life. We have 3 hot meals a day, snacks, soup and sandwiches overnight. We have shower facilities, washroom facilities. We have clothing that's donated that the women use. And in the drop-in, we also have various activities, social recreation activities for the women. And then we have what we call a whole range of wraparound services. We have people that specialize in housing, trying to help our women become properly housed. We have 4 medical doctors, 3 psychiatrists. We have a psychotherapist from the Jean Tweed Center, have an immigration specialist from West Neighborhood House. We have a very robust harm reduction program for people that are struggling with substance use. And then in-house, we have a whole range of social workers who provide different types of counseling and support and housing help as well.
And who are the women who are accessing these services generally?
There is no stereotypical women. We have women currently in the drop-in from 18 to well into their 80s. We have, sadly, a number of older senior citizens that stay here. And as you said, we are a drop-in space, not a shelter, so we don't have beds. We have 12 reclining chairs, and then people get mats on the floor or the bare floor if we run out of mats. Those are the people that actually stay here. And we have women here that have actually lived here for 2 years since we opened 24/7. And that's because there are, as you know, not enough shelter beds, not enough supportive, affordable housing. And then I guess the bulk of our people would probably be between 35 and middle 60s, I'd say. And we have women with various physical and mental disabilities, large cultural populations, a very large Asian population, a large Spanish-speaking population, and we've been working over the last year and or so with a number of Syrian women, people that have been brought into Canada as refugees, and we've been providing program for them as well.
Sistering described itself as a low-barrier space. What does that mean, and why is that important?
What it means is that we tolerate a very wide range of behavior, and most of the women that come here have been barred or restricted from using other drop-in centers or shelter facilities, and that's due primarily to their mental health issues and substance use. So originally, the 24-hour drop-in was created to provide a safe space for women overnight. And as we've become known, our population has increased dramatically. And we welcome and work with people, or women that come in where, you know, wherever they happen to be in their particular life journey. We don't set curfews. We don't set standards of behavior. We really try to work with them however they present themselves when they come through the door.
Yeah, and you said that your population has increased dramatically. And I was reading in your 2016-2017 annual report, it says that you have seen a significant increase in the number of women with complex mental health issues. Can you talk about how why that's continued to rise and what sistering is in need of to address that, or if you're getting enough support for that?
We absolutely don't have enough support for that. The first night we stayed open 24 hours, we had three women that came in who were in significant mental health distress, and we were able to work with them, keep them safe, keep the other women in the space safe, and prevented them from having to go to hospital. And that next morning, I got on the phone to all of our funders and said, we need mental health, specifically highly trained mental health support staff, be they mental health nurses or others trained staff. And that's over 2 years ago, and we haven't got those resources yet, but we desperately need more highly trained mental health workers. The other issue that we're facing, a very practical issue, is we have totally outgrown the building we're in. Each of our offices has two or more people in it. A lot of our staff do not have an office at all. Even our senior director doesn't have an office, and she operates from a laptop, walking around the building, plopping down wherever she can find a space. So we need mental health supports, and we need a bigger building. The other thing that's absolutely critical to the shelter system is that we need what we would call a low barrier shelter for our, the women that come to Cistern that can't go other places. And we're actually working on a proposal now that we're going to submit to the city to see if one of the three shelters that the city has promised for this year could be designated as a Cistern shelter for our clientele. We have a 79-year-old woman who was evicted from her apartment now well over 2 years ago, and she spends her time at Cistern and one of the women's shelters in Toronto. And when she's here, she puts together three kitchen chairs and sleeps on those. So you can imagine people sleeping in a place that's quite noisy. Everyone doesn't sleep overnight, and the people have difficulties and they start yelling or whatever. Nobody gets proper rest, and certainly not an almost 80-year-old.
Can you touch on some of the challenges that women specifically face when they find themselves in a position of precarious housing or homelessness?
Well, a number of things happen. You have women that stay in unsafe relationships, in abusive relationships, because they don't have another place to go. They're not safe in their own home, and there's not suitable shelter or housing for them to go to. So they're at physical risk, and the mental health deteriorates. They don't have proper food, they don't have proper sleep, and it just leads to increasing medical problems. And you had mentioned the complex mental health and physical health issues our women have. I mean, they come from being homeless or not having the proper shelter.
Yeah. Do you work with trans women as well at Cistern?
Yes, we do. We have a very, actually quite a large trans population here, and that sometimes presents challenges for some of our women. We have, as I mentioned, a number of senior women, and it's been fairly challenging to educate them to accept trans women. And it's much, much better now than it was 2 years ago. And it's a pretty safe trans space, I'd say, now.
I see. Cistern opened its doors in the 80s, I believe. Was that correct?
Actually, 36 years ago.
Yeah. And it was started by...
So early 80s.
Yeah. So I read that it was started by women and community workers who saw that the needs of vulnerable women were not being met in Toronto. So in the past 30-ish years, I know you've only been with Cistern for 3 years, But do you think that things have changed since the early days of sistering, or are there still the same issues that you're fighting for?
Well, it's interesting. The short answer is it hasn't changed. It's only gotten to be a more necessary service. But we have two women here that still work here who were working at Scatting Court, where sistering was first started. And they say that the population that we're seeing now over the last couple of years is exactly the same population that they saw at the very beginning. And that's at the time when the province deinstitutionalized people, saying, closing the various institutions, saying that the community would, people would be absorbed into the community and community supports would be provided, which they never were. And that's why the leaders in women in Toronto at that time started sistering. And I think the need is greater now than it was even then.
Toronto homelessness and anti-poverty activists like yourselves have been calling for supports for the overcapacity shelter for a long time now. But this latest severe cold snap that took place in January has obviously led to significantly more public and media attention on the issue. Do you think that the latest steps that the city has been taking to open the new shelters or to plan for new shelters and to open the armory, are those meaningful steps in your view to address the issue currently?
Well, they were necessary steps to deal with the emergency. They were way too late to put them in place. We, as you said, we've been advocating since the last budget cycle last year. We started advocating for more shelter beds that haven't appeared until the very recently. The city, we, the activist community, has been telling the politicians, and I put my words directed at the politicians because the staff in the city have been great in shelter support and housing, but the politicians have not been listening to us. I did a deputation with other people to the Board of Health in the fall. And the chair of the Board of Health just said to me, "You're wrong. Your figures are wrong. You don't have this right. We have the accurate figures, and we don't need what you're asking for." And then we went to the Community Development and Recreation Committee, and again there were more of us with more actual data. And at that point, he finally, the penny dropped for him, and he finally agreed that that there was a problem. But it's been a huge push for activists and, I must say, mostly members of the left of council to get this matter, to get the attention of other councillors. And it was tough to get the mayor's attention. He kept saying that he was listening to his expert civil service and another housing organization, but he never once met with those of us in the shelter and drop-in sector. So he totally missed getting our input into our into his decision-making process, and therefore he just kept putting it off. And then as it became really evident that there was no space, they opened the Better Living Center and then finally the armories. So I think it took this really cold time and the fact that we've been pushing so hard for additional shelter space to get the attention. And as we've been saying, winter comes every year in Toronto, and it was left again till the last minute, and then people were scrambling to find spaces. And they're not great spaces, but they're, you know, out of the elements. And the big thing that's now worrying us is people have shelter over their head of some sort until April, and then all of these drop-ins and temporary facilities are going to close, and the same hundreds of people that are sleeping on mats now will still need a place to sleep in April.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what does the future of sistering look like, and the future of the people that use your services if the city's current course of addressing homelessness continues?
Well, we'll continue to provide the service here that we can. We continue to operate over capacity because I cannot imagine a circumstance that I would turn away a woman from here unless I had another place for her to go to. We're going to continue to advocate, in our case, for the low barrier shelter for women. And there's, in my view, need for another low barrier women's 24-hour drop-in in the east end of the city, sort of main Victoria Park, Warden kind of area. So I think that's a real need. And then generally, we'll continue to work with our partners in this sector to make sure that the politicians at all levels of government understand that there's hundreds of people in the city that don't have adequate shelter and have, in some cases, really terrible conditions. They might have a room, lots of basement apartments, lots of leaky spaces, lots of unheated spaces, that kind of thing. But that's not suitable living conditions for anybody. And we just have to keep this issue on the radar. And I'm hopeful that with the city municipal election and the provincial election this year, that more than the left-leaning politicians will pay attention to this issue.
Mm-hmm. How can our listeners support the work that Sistering does? You mentioned that you are pushing for one of these shelters to be opened in support of Sistering. Is there a way that listeners can support your push for that?
Absolutely. If they wanted to write to the mayor and their councillor or other councillors, if they wanted to write to the Minister of Housing in the provincial government, join in any of the advocacy efforts we have. I'd love to actually be able to connect with students, because they're really the future of Sistering, and to get them engaged in these vital fights, for lack of a better word, because to get people to pay attention to the most vulnerable, you need to be out there and noticeable. So writing, organizing events, that kind of thing. In the broader picture and in the day-to-day of Sistering, we always need volunteers. We need supplies for the women, soap, shampoo, conditioner, hygiene products, all that kind of thing. So if people wanted to do a little drive for those practical everyday things we need, that would be really appreciated as well.
All right. So people can visit sistering.org for more info about that.
That's correct.
All right. Well, Patricia, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for the work that you do.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate you getting the word out.
Thanks to Emily Joveski for that interview. The interview originally aired on the January 22nd episode of Femme Radio. You're listening to the Homelessness Marathon on your local community radio station. This hour, we're bringing you programming from CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. Radio Totally Normal Toronto is a monthly program produced by Progress Place, a mental health recovery center located in Toronto. RTNT explores and showcases stories and new initiatives from Toronto's diverse mental health community. Jerry and Andrew of RTNT recently sat down with Jesse Serdiergo from Yonge Street Mission to hear his thoughts on youth homelessness in Toronto. Jesse works with street-involved youth at Evergreen Drop-In Center, providing a wide variety of services from meals to mental health support in order to help youth transition out of homelessness.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes. All right. My name is Jesse Serdiergo. I'm from the Yonge Street Mission Evergreen Center. I'm the director of Street Involved Services.
Great. Great to have you. Can you tell us a little about yourself and your work?
Sure. Yeah. I've been working at the Yonge Street Mission for 5 years now. I stepped into the role that I'm in right now for the past 2 years. And so Evergreen Center is a part of the Yonge Street Mission. It's one of the places that's actually in the main site that started with the Yonge Street Mission like 100 and something years ago, like 1890 something. It's like a long, it looks like a stable inside there, at least at first. And so we've been there for a long time, but we've been serving street involved youth for the past since the 1980s and focused on street youth in general since then. And so I've been there for the past 5 years just learning a lot.
What does street involved mean?
That's a good question. So the way we define who we serve and who we're in community with at Evergreen is youth who spend like most of their waking day on the streets, you know, and they're part of the street culture. You know, they find themselves either they're living rough on the streets, which is a smaller percentage now than it was, I think, before. Or they're, you know, precariously housed, or they are living in shelters, or couch surfing and things like that. And so we deal with a lot of the youth who that's kind of their living situation, but culturally, like, they find themselves on the streets a lot and they spend most of their waking day really on there, whether it's the activities that they do and all that sorts. Yeah.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I mean, we get asked this question a lot at Progress Place. Like, you're saying, you know, street-involved youths who are in shelter. Like, is Evergreen the services you guys provide? What does that look like? Are you a shelter?
Yeah. So to put it shortly, we're like a one-stop shop for everything street-involved youth, but we are not a shelter. We're a day program, and so we're open from 9 to 6 p.m. during the winters, and we close at 5 p.m. in the summertime. But our open drop-in hours are from 6 p.m. And we have lunch, and we have dinner there. And what I mean by one-stop shop is that we got food. We just got a space where people can come in. There's no registration table in the front that you have to stop into. You can just literally come in. You can have complete anonymity and just hang out and play pool or play foosball or just meet up with your friends there or talk to a staff. Actually, when we did a survey, our youth say that their top reason is food for coming there, but their second top reason is just to talk to a staff, just to someone, a healthy adult relationship. And so our approach is that we don't really have people who are coming at others like a formal social worker. Everyone's coming and eating with each other and like talking casually over some, you know, pool and all that kind of stuff. That's the main level. But then we have programs in addition to that. You know, we could do karaoke there. We do some dance. We do some, we do have a social enterprise there. We do art space. We do a lot of different activities and that kind of, we make beats and all that kind of stuff and music. And that's kind of the low barrier programs that we have that people can just drop in to be a part of. You don't have to register or anything. And then in our other section of Evergreen in the basement, we have employment programs, which is a huge contingency of our what we do there. Employment, and we have housing services, which kind of refer people to housing. And then we have a health center that has everything that you could ever ask for, whether it's a doctor, a chiro, a physio, a dentist, Chinese medicine, acupuncture, podiatrists, psychiatrists, everything that you could ever ask for, all the medical and paramedical things are there, and they offer it for free in a drop-in basis. So there's like it's every day there's usually a doctor or a nurse practitioner every day, and a dentist or a hygienist every day.
Every day.
Is they rotate dentist, hygienist, even dental surgeons. You have someone who came with a toothache in the morning, and they got a root canal done by the end of the day. They didn't even know that they were going to they didn't even know they had a root canal. And so we just so happened to have the surgeon there that day. But that's the kind of mentality. We just want things like ready to go as much as possible. Chiro, for example, or physiotherapy, those are maybe once or twice a week.
Yeah, and I think you know, we've done, or I've done some youth specific training, and you know what we hear a lot is that immediate access to services is really important, because somebody might stop in and then need, you know, a service, and as they should receive it. But if you're not able to provide it right away, they may not come back again, and they may never receive that service.
Yeah, because appointments are hard to keep. You know, like it's hard for me to keep. You know what I'm saying? Like my wife has to remind me, my Google calendar. Yeah. And so imagine if you're living rough on the streets and you have a lot of barriers and, you know, going through a lot of different things that you can be thinking about. And then you have to think about an appointment as well. So we just want to make it as convenient as possible.
Do we know how many youth are currently experiencing homelessness in Toronto?
Yeah, that's a hard one. There's a lot of different stats out there. They say like 9,000 to 10,000 right now in Toronto, but it can be invisible homelessness. Like people don't know the certain situations, and a lot of the times the youth are homeless, and then they are housed for a season, or they stay at a friend's house for a while, and so it doesn't look like they're homeless. A lot of the times, because you're youth and you're homeless, you usually kind of come with the stuff that you just had, right? And you just ran away from home or whatnot, so you don't look all that homeless sometimes as well. Many of the youth, they come with, you know, their Jordans and all that. It doesn't project like that because homelessness is new to them, versus someone who may have been homeless for a while. It could be, it look more evident. And so sometimes I think it's hard to detect, you know, but in our place, we serve around 4,000 youth a year, and we see probably 130 youth a day, some regular, some not.
What are the benefits of stable housing?
That's a great question. What's the benefits of it? Like, so first of all, when you don't know where you're going to sleep, there's so much stress in that, you know, and in alone. And so that compounds the barriers just alone right away. You don't even know where you're going to stay, you know. And so first of all, like for youth, stable housing is good. But for youth particularly, and the most recent, you know, things that have been coming out and models and studies that have been coming out, have been indicating the need for not just housing for youth, but like some transitional housing. It's not only important to get stable housing, it's to get stable, usually transitional supportive housing, you know, one that actually gives those extra supports for someone who's new getting independent housing, you know. And so that's what we find, and it's not exclusive to youth, but I mean, we find that for youth particularly, because it's their first time out on it. And so it really gives them a base to be stable from. But on this other side, stable housing is great, but without community that the youth feel, because normally youth is dislodged from their neighborhood, number one, and then they're on the streets for a bit, and then they have to be situated in another neighborhood where they're housed. They know no one, you know, they don't have any kind of, there's no guidance counselor that's around that they grew up with. There's no, all that stuff, their friends, they're dislocated from that stuff. And so it's a huge problem that they have the housing, but they have no community. And so they go back to the streets and they start to hustle, or they start to do other things, you know, that was familiar with them and people that they kind of knew back on the street when they were. So it's a cycle sometimes, and it's hard. They say youth go back and forth in and out of homelessness probably 3 to 5 times on average before they actually get out of homelessness. So
what barriers exist that prevent youth experience homelessness and mental issues, health issues, and or addiction issues from accessing stable, good housing?
Oh, there's so many barriers, you know, because first of all, like many of them don't want to go to counseling, right? They don't want to be seen stigmatized based on going to a counselor. They see it sometimes as a weakness, you know. And so number one, like accessibility to just counseling in at first, number one, like how do you get it, like who's going to give it to me, and do I trust this person? Say if you grew up in the system, then everything you encounter, you're always with a worker, and then suddenly there's certain kind of relationship that you just don't like as a result of it, or maybe you do like it. But then it just kind of makes you feel very hesitant with people who are seeing you sometimes as a number, or seeing you as someone who is a project, because you'd be treating like a project a lot of your life, you know. And so just access to the service is difficult. You know, I'm not sure if I'm hitting exactly your question, but access to the service. And that's why, you know, a storefront model for mental health is, I think, a great model, because you just want to make it really easy for them to access that mental health. You know, just what you're saying for the doctors and the dentists, same thing with the mental health. We just want to make it, that's why our mental health workers are eating with them at lunchtime, you know what I mean? And just being there in community so that they're familiar with them and they can have a conversation with a counselor before they even know that they're really doing what you're doing in counseling. And then hopefully if they want to, they can, you know, access more. And so we have a variety of people. We have like people, because we're kind of like a Evergreen is a place where other mental health workers come to, like addiction workers from other places, from like Central Toronto Youth Services or Breakaway Addictions or YMCA Substance Abuse Program. They all kind of use our center because we have the foot traffic there to meet with their clients. And so many of them are just kind of hanging out there. And then they just engage with the community members there.
So it's not necessarily just Evergreen staff kind of that are there meeting with clients. Like there's oftentimes like outreach workers and stuff like that in Evergreen meeting with, like, is it like maybe trying to help out some potentially new clients?
So it's we have a mental health collaborative. So we have a mental health collaborative that meets quarterly, and they include people who are two psychiatrists coming on our site every week. So we have 2 days of psychiatry. We have, you know, those addiction workers I was talking about there, outreach workers, you know, people who are going through psychosis, like real rough on the streets, you know, might be talking to themselves on the streets, like, and are, don't want to necessarily engage in an institution. You know, they have outreach workers who really engage with that really well, and they come to our place as well. And so we're an open door to them as well. We like to build a relationship first with them, and then they can come and go as they please, and just to be a part of the center. That's really helpful because we don't have, you know, the funding in our place to have all those different types of mental health workers. And so we just say, hey, flood our place with other mental health workers so that these youth can engage with someone, you know. And so it's really a benefit, you know. We kind of triage that to kind of make sure everyone knows, hey, there's this happening here, you know, and we have a lot of that going on.
In your opinion, is it possible to house every person in Toronto, and how do we get there?
I think based on the resources that our city has and how rich our city is, I think it is possible. The question is whether we can efficiently make that happen. I think there will always be episodical kind of homelessness that will happen. You know, people will go through those. But, you know, actually one of our tasks, our mission statement at our vision for the Yongshu Mission, ironically, as you asked this question, is to end chronic poverty in one generation, which is a very ambitious goal. But the reason why we say that is because we are striving to see, like, literally, we don't want to see the status quo anymore. And we want to see, like, the rallying of all the resources that occur and let people start to think differently about what we actually have and how we can work together. So it's forcing us as an organization to work collaboratively with people to say that we can't do it alone, you know. As big as we are as a center for street involved youth, it's not going to be suffice. It's just part of the puzzle, you know. We're a drop-in center and a center, a one-stop shop, but we need to interact with other organizations like Covenant House or like Sketch or like other places that do a different function. And so I think it's possible. But it takes both a political and also certain will for us and a collaborative will for us to actually organize to do so. But it's ambitious kind of.
And kind of going back to the last question, you know, possibility of housing every person in with your mission statement. Like, I wonder, like, how much you feel educating the public kind of plays into that in terms of like the resources that are available and you know, in terms of advocating, you know, that the, you know, public funds be used for, you know, those. I'm just wondering your perspective on that.
Yeah, so I mean, we're, for example, a good example for the public is all the basement rental apartments, for example, that you know, we want to see used for perhaps lower lower rates or whatnot. So it can be a place that we can help provide perhaps the social support to a land, like a landlord would be kind of concerned, you know, if someone who's in part of street-involved culture and coming into their place, perhaps the nonprofit can help with alleviating that a little bit by saying, hey, you know what, we'll be there to support maybe perhaps the social side of it and deal with maybe certain things that might come up so you're not alone. You know, we do this also with employment. In our employment programs, for example, we have partnerships with certain organizations like, say, Starbucks. And we say, you know, we have some funding to get someone trained in your place. We'll pay for them to be trained as a barista. You train them. We'll pay for it. At the end of it, you guys can, if you see like the work that they're doing, you can hire them on. And you just got free training, you know, and we paid for your training. It's good for us because we got a foot in the door for someone perhaps, you know, with a record or has trouble getting interviews or whatnot because of a lot of different barriers. We get our foot in the door, but they also get a benefit and we kind of do that. And I think same with like with landlords and certain things like that. If we can see the public sphere and say to them, hey, we can perhaps provide that support. We're reaching out, like we're a faith-based organization, and so we have a lot of contacts with churches, and we're trying to reach out to churches now saying, hey, you know, if you guys want to do some good as churches, maybe you have some, you know, some in-law suite that you want to rent out, you know, that you, is open there. We can help provide some support for that if you can open that up perhaps for our youth.
Homelessness can seem like an overwhelming and unsolvable problem. How do you think an individual can contribute to the solution, and how do you think we, as a society, can solve it?
Yeah, this might sound quite floaty, but I think that it begins with humanizing the experience of our interactions with the homeless in our daily walks through the downtown or anywhere we are. Number one, I think that is essential in bringing humanity back to those who are homeless. Because it's so undignifying to stand on the street for one and ask for money and do those things at times for some and for most. And I think it's important for us to kind of, number one, see their humanity. Number one, that's one way to engage and to engage in conversation. And some people say, hey, don't give money to the homeless or whatnot. It's just enabling or whatnot. But I say, hey, you know, what the heck, you know, just engage, you know, if it's a way to engage and stop and say hello and recognize, I think that's an important thing. So that's just the surface kind of level of thing that I find quite important because it's the beginning. It's dignifying someone who comes into your convenience store and not assuming they're going to take something and greeting them first, not with suspicion, but greeting them with a welcome. Though it changes the dynamic of what could be the outcome of that interaction, you know. And I think we live in a society of such suspicion and such, you know, wondering of the unknown of things that people that are unfamiliar to us. And so it's not to be naive, but I think that's a good way to start. And I think it's not like you have to force it. I think it comes from a just like what I was saying about, for me, I had supportive housing when I was, you know, getting my first place. It's actually seeing that I'm not that different from people who are experiencing barriers. That if I went through similar things, I would probably be where they are as well. And just also just seeing how really close I am to certain things. There could be people who are on the streets tend to be very overt with their inadequacies, and it's like really blaring in front of everyone. But I have a lot of things that I am not so proud of myself, but I'm really good at concealing them perhaps, you know. And so I think there's both, like the way we put it at the Young Street Mission is there's, we can resonate with those negatives, but also we in our language that we say, and you know, we're a faith-based organization, we see the image of God in people, you know. We see that there's something beautiful in them, and it's like you just have to stop and wait and see, like what is great about them that I wouldn't see at first glance. And then you just gotta, and really it doesn't take that long, and you find something real beautiful in someone, and you can just hone in on that. So it's not like a forced thing to have to relate with people who are homeless. It's actually pretty simple when you have a sober view of yourself and you have a good view of and a positive view of people, you know. So
thank you, thanks for coming by, and you know, well, hopefully we'll see you again sometime soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
to Jerry and Andrew and the entire RTNT team for that interview. Why Are You is a youth-led, youth-produced, and youth-engaged radio show that spotlights the stories of young people from social justice issues, living away from home, and experiencing marginalization. Why Are You is a platform for young people to be seen, to be heard, and to voice themselves as experts in their own lives. Marty Daly recently produced an episode weaving together the stories of three youth who have experienced homelessness. Here's a shortened version of that piece.
Homelessness can happen to anyone. It happened to me. And in a prosperous city like Toronto, I am a statistic. To experience homelessness is to be part of a silenced population. Our children, neighbors, bankers, lawyers, people from all walks of life have been confronted with the loss of confidence, dignity, and security associated with not being able to return home. Homelessness is right before our eyes, but to be homeless is still stigmatizing. The city of Toronto has an estimated homeless population of 5,000, and in a city of more than 2 million people, that statistic may seem small. But in May 2017, over 4,800 men, women, and children used the emergency shelter system on an average night. That statistic is 17.5% higher than May 2016. We often don't take into account that homelessness is a spectrum. When I experienced situations of homelessness growing up, from the outside, no one could tell. I was a straight-A student athlete. I showed up to school every day, but no one could come to my house because sometimes what I knew as my house was only that for a few weeks at a time. No one could call because there was no phone to use. No one could know, because my secret would be met with confrontation of my reality. I was homeless. My story is not unique. I experienced hidden homelessness for the greater part of my life growing up. Today, follow me through other stories of triumphing against odds and navigating what it means to have been homeless as a young person.
I usually use Erica Groff.
When you were a kid, knowing what you do right now, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, it's funny, Marty. Actually, when I grew up, I always wanted to be an archaeologist.
Wow.
I actually, I lived on a farm, and on that farm from centuries ago, I went with centuries, but years and years and years, it was a 100-year-old farmhouse, there was an old dump. And when I was a kid, I used to like to go down and dig, and I'd find all these like really bizarre bottles and wheels and all kinds of things that I thought were such treasures that I'd bring home and clean up. And I thought that I'd want to dig up like ruins for the rest of my life. Ironically, now I'm a social worker and I work with young people who are struggling with mental health and addiction issues. I guess I'm actually a director of a community agency, and I have a staff of about 22, and we're servicing about 800 youth right now. But I think I still find that digging up really interesting. Like when I meet someone, I want to know what their past is. I want to know who they are, what they're about. So I think that thread still runs strong.
So as you know, for the segment that I'm trying to produce right now, I'm looking at the question of home and homelessness and what do these things mean to different people. So I'm really curious about your experience. I understand that you have prior experience being homeless. When did this happen? What was going on?
The first time I left home, I was probably around 15. And I left home because I was actually being sexually assaulted in the family home by someone who worked for us. For the family business. And I ran to get away from that, and I just ran into actually more and more trouble with people I met during the running.
What was your immediate response when you found out that you couldn't return home or that your home was unsafe?
I felt really alienated. I felt really sad. I felt really isolated. I felt alone. And I also felt like I was just going to dig my heels in and somehow survive.
So before you were 15, was there any time where you anticipated that this might be what you had to do?
Never a million years did I anticipate what would happen to me. I was just a regular young girl living the life, enjoyed riding horses, enjoyed a lot of activities, and then bam, I was brought into a world I had no idea.
How did being homeless affect your daily life, especially since you were a teenager, young adult?
Well, it affected my life because I had to learn how to survive, which means you had to make money, which led to doing things you probably didn't want to, that were shameful. I ended up doing a lot of drugs, becoming pretty addicted to drugs, actually, and having to do all kinds of like stealing and stuff to survive.
And do you have trouble normalizing this experience to other people now that you're older, you're established, that life might seem really far away?
It does seem far away, and unfortunately I still feel like there's a lot of stigma, and I probably don't talk about it often, and I don't normalize it because I'm afraid of that stigma still.
Coming from that, it's hard to figure out, like, how did you finally resolve that for yourself? Like, how did you move away from being homeless and to going back to the average day?
I guess at one point I got into a lot of trouble and I was sort of mandated into treatment. I wouldn't say treatment actually worked at that time, but it got me thinking. So then after several more squalid years, I went to treatment again where I actually wanted to go. And at that point I thought, you know, Erica, you're really smart. You're a smart cookie and you can go back to school and you can do things with your life and you don't need to live in this seedy underworld that you're living in. So that was the day I decided to start heading home. Ironically, I mean, I feel sorry for the young person that had to endure what that person had to endure and the mental health that followed that and the struggles I've had over my life, actually. But career-wise, how I've helped so many young people deal with their own struggles, I think in that way it was worth it. And I think it made me the counselor, the director, and the person I am. It certainly built my character. But there's still that piece of me, that inner child, that is still hurt and wounded.
So you're very accomplished, but if you could pick one of your best accomplishments, which would it be? What are you most proud of?
I think my proudest accomplishment is acknowledging that I was not well and that I had to get help and not being ashamed of getting the help and spending, honestly, probably 10 to 12 years in therapy and having the courage to go on and just now actually starting to tell my story a bit.
What do you think home means?
Home to me is a place where sort of a soft place to fall, where you're grounded, where you have roots, where you're not judged, where you feel unconditional love, and it's a place that you belong. Anybody can have a home, but you need to create a home. You need to create that that space, that energy, that place.
You just heard a condensed version of a piece that originally aired on YRU. To hear the entire episode and for other notes on the programming that you've just heard, you can visit cjru.ca and look for the Homelessness Marathon 18 show notes. Many thanks to Local 107.3 FM for organizing and hosting this year's marathon.